From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for September 9th, 2022. Checking the calendar, the Packers kick off their season this Sunday in Minnesota with the Vikings. The Brewers host the Reds this weekend, and at the Summerfest grounds, it's Taco Fest. Now for something completely different. This Sunday, the School Sisters of St. Francis, those would be nuns, are hosting an Oktoberfest at the St. Joseph Center. And no, I'm not kidding, it's on their website. My grade school nuns must be spinning like lathes in their graves. Let's start with kind of a freaky story. A Japanese man who married a hologram 4 years ago can no longer communicate with his virtual wife. The software is no longer being supported, and that means he can no longer interact with the hologram, whatever that means. From Canada, a Winnipeg mayoral candidate with a campaign promise to reduce bicycle theft had his bike stolen. An Oxnard, California man pleaded guilty to federal smuggling charges. According to the Justice Department, he's been smuggling reptiles into the U.S. for some time. I hope you're sitting down for this, because he can't. When he was arrested, he had 60 snakes in his pants. U.S. ambassadorships are usually awarded to longtime political movers and shakers and large financial donors. The U.S. is planning to appoint an ambassador to the Arctic. This is brilliant. A lot of big donors will pay big money not to go. And finally, in Sydney, Australia, there's a nightclub that I want no part of. I know I ended that sentence with a preposition, but it works. The nightclub has a policy that customers cannot stare at other customers without their consent. So you go to the club, you order a drink, you see an attractive person, and you walk up to them and say, "Hi, can I stare at you?" Oh, that's not creepy at all. On the podcast today, we have four people who are not making eye contact. Art Rothschild, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Titting.
Well, thanks, Max. A good week for jokes. Short four-day trading week. The S&P up 3.6% this week, closing today at 4067. The NASDAQ up 4.1%. Closing today at 12,112, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 2.7% this week. Closing at the bell, 32,152 for the year, including dividends. The NASDAQ now down 22.2% for the year. The S&P down 13.7%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 10.2%. On the week, the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury moved a little bit higher, closing the week at 3.32%. And I think, you know, importantly, the story this week, Art, very much continues to be inflation, very much continues to be the Fed, very much continues to be all of these things that seem to be emerging. And I think you pointed out in kind of our preparation today, there seem to be kind of these three undercurrents to the markets. And they all made their way onto the front page of the Wall Street Journal on Thursday. Certainly conversations we've been having, but, you know, you lay them all out there for us.
Yeah, it's good to see that we've been talking about the same thing that everybody else has been talking about all year long. The first and foremost of which is the Fed raising interest rates. I mean, there's no surprise here. We knew they were going to do it. People second-guessed them. Oh, they took too long to start. And then they're going too strongly, raising interest rates too much or not raising them enough. Is it too hot, too cold? And the impact that's going to have on the economy and the markets. Are we going to have a recession? Is it going to be long? Is it going to be short? When's it going to start? So that's issue number one, and we can talk more about that later. The second one is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I would argue that there's much more certainty in Fed policy. We know what they're trying to accomplish, which is reducing inflation. We know what they're going to do to accomplish that. We just don't know exactly how and when. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is an intangible that caused prices to go higher. It exacerbated the inflation problem early on, but now it's kind of having the opposite effect because it's causing growth to slow in Europe. So we've got a changing perspective on that. But as it drags on, there's serious problems here about the impact on long-term growth, you know, in Europe, you know, in the world, and the impact of more serious, you know, altercations between major powers. And the third one, somewhat related, is China. China's consistent policy vis-a-vis COVID which quite frankly has failed. They lock things down at the first sign of a sniffle from somebody, and that's screwing up the global supply chain every time it happens. But that is kind of okay for us to a certain extent because, well, it runs at cross purposes. Their economy is slowing, so they don't have as much demand, but the global economy is slowing, so there isn't as much demand. If there's not as much demand, then prices shouldn't go up as high. Production of chips is catching up, not potato chips, but computer chips. And so I'm concerned long-term about mistakes they're making and about their possible altercations with, you know, Taiwan or the rest of the world, and they're not supporting our policy vis-a-vis the war in Europe. But those are the three big ones for the year. And one out of three, and I think the most significant for us at the present time, is the Fed. And I like what's going on there, and the market obviously did, you know, this week.
Yeah, I think it was clear this week with even more comments from the Fed that a 75 basis point hike in a couple of weeks is all but baked into the cake at this point. I think the market has come to understand that it's necessary. You had Jay Powell talking about trying to avoid some of the social pain, you know, maybe the word pain coming back or the allusion to pain coming back this week, but him indicating that, you know, perhaps we can avoid some of the biggest social, you know, detriment that might come from slowing the economy enough to get inflation under control. And, you know, Paige, I think we're very often focused on inflation here in the U.S., and yet the European Central Bank this week raised their interest rates, 75 basis points, in an effort to do the very thing that we're trying to do here in the U.S. And, of course, I think the problem that Europe has is that the line between cutting inflation and halting growth entirely is even thinner than it is here in the U.S. It's going to be a tricky proposition for the Fed to get this right. But when you look at much of the rest of the world, in Europe in particular, I think it's an even more difficult proposition for them to get the inflation thing under control without pushing Europe into a fourth or fifth recession in the span of what's been two for us.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Europe is obviously a complicated issue. I mean, number one, they haven't had the same type of growth that we've seen in the United States over the last 10 years before COVID. So that definitely was a detriment to them as well. And we can't forget that the European Union, while it is a union, each economy is different. So think back to 2015, we were talking about the issues with Greece. And then we started talking about the issues with Italy. Now we have issues with Germany being a little bit too dependent on Russian oil, and that impacts is going to impact the rest of the European economy, but each one is unique. And so we tend to look at them as one homogeneous group, but it's times like these where you start to look and say, okay, everyone's being impacted differently. Who's really going to have the most pain and who's going to have the most benefit? So like you said, the ECB is going to have a hard time sort of walking that line. When you add into it, like we said, the oil concerns and, you know, coming into a cold winter here, there's going to be issues with shutdowns, potentially needing to limit some of the energy usage. So you couple that with the inflation and rising interest rates, and they may be in for a bit of a rougher ride than what we're seeing here in the U.S. So on a relative basis, we look pretty good, but definitely focusing on, you know, how some of these policy changes are going to impact, you know, different areas of the European market.
And this is sort of how it's been, Paige, right? I mean, even after the Great Recession, the U.S. came out of it a little quicker, a little healthier than did Europe, you know, at the same time that that the Fed here was, you know, arguing for fiscal policies that would be spending more money to put more money into the economy. Christine Lagarde, who was then the head of the International Monetary Fund and now is the head of the European Central Bank, she was, you know, preaching austerity. And then gradually they came around and they sort of said, well, maybe austerity really isn't helping here.
Yeah, but I think it's a good reminder, too. You know, here in the U.S., like Art was saying, we got the Federal Reserve raising interest rates with the primary goal of combating inflation. Other areas of our economy, they're not overheating. They look pretty good on a relative basis. It really is all about the inflation picture right now. And the fact that the European Union is facing these sort of headwinds right now, and they're still raising rates to combat inflation, it just reinforces, you the issue that it's a global problem. The Fed can do what they can to try to decrease demand, but that may not have the intended impact on prices. And so I think we need to start looking at what they're doing and say, okay, maybe we're not going to get down to 2% inflation while they're raising interest rates. And that's okay, because they really have to walk this fine line of, trying to combat that while not pushing us into a recession.
I think one thing we have seen is that because of how quickly the Fed has moved, and certainly I think the argument has been not quick enough, but because they've moved more quickly than many other central banks around the world, the dollar has been incredibly strong relative to other currencies. And so in many ways, that's helped U.S. consumers a little bit keep inflation down just a touch, because the price of goods you're bringing in from other places is a little cheaper than it otherwise would be. Think of that in reverse as a European consumer. If you want to buy American-made goods right now as a European consumer, the dollar is 12.5% stronger than a broad basket of global currencies year to date. Well, okay, it's 12.5% more expensive for you if you're a consumer outside the U.S. trying to buy those U.S.-made goods. So that's just one more inflationary pressure in other places around the world. And so, I think it's one more way that the Fed has gotten ahead of the problem as much as, maybe they could have, again, with the argument that they can be and will be doing more.
It's interesting to think about the difference between the interrelationship of us and the rest of the world now versus what it was back in 2018 and 2019. So we have to be cognizant of the fact that a recession somewhere else can affect us here. But what's the Fed going to do about it if it does? And in 2019, they lowered rates after raising them in 2018 because there was a recession starting in Europe and around the rest of the world. So the real question is, how much do we have to worry? And with these guys on guard, I'm not sure we have to worry too much. I think the Fed's doing a great job, here. As Paige indicated, over there, they're weaker. I mean, it's problematical for them. But again, a recession is problematical for us. But because of the team we have in place at our Federal Reserve, I think we have to feel that if things do get weaker here, they will lower rates. We don't want them to, because we want them to win the war against inflation. They've made that clear. Comment that Chairman Powell made yesterday, I believe, this is not physics, okay? They don't know exactly what's going to happen anytime they do what they do. But they've said enough over the course of this, interest rate rising period that I'm confident they're looking ahead to the potential consequences, not just behind to what they've done. And they've made it very clear, despite the fact that the market got ahead of itself a month ago in anticipating the Fed would at some point start lowering rates, this Fed isn't going to lower rates. This Fed isn't going to stop raising rates until we do see progress. And Paige, I totally agree with you. They don't have to get it down to 2%, but they have to have it going in the right direction. And then watch for the market rally when they do say, this is it for a while. And then we're going to see the same thing we saw in July, but by some multiple. And I think that could drive the rest of the world forward.
Art, I was reading some comments today from Christopher Waller, not Christopher Walker, but Christopher Waller. He's a Fed gov, and he was speaking in Texas, and he was saying, just that point that so we're expecting to see the consumer price index next week, which is the broadest measure we have of inflation, and by some forecasts, that's expected to be going down, and it went down in July, and it went, and we're seeing other indicators that inflation might be decelerating. And he said, I don't care. If we see a couple of months of deceleration in inflation, that's not good enough. We still need to raise interest rates to make sure that we've got inflation under control.
What I think is so interesting is the number of prognosticators that look at all of this and then start to say, okay, well, the Fed's going to cause this, and here's where the market's going to be on this date. And, it's headline grabbing. It certainly captures investors' attention. But I think the reality of forecasting is just the track record of forecasting is just so poor that, if anything, if you don't predict either a really big number or a really small number, A, nobody's going to pay attention, but B, nobody's going to remember. And so we kind of get this You know, all the big banks out there, the big investment banks out there, their chief investment officers look at what the Fed is saying, or they look at, you know, the latest print at GDP and go, okay, well, here's what we're concerned about and here's what the market's going to look like in kind of the best case and worst case scenario. We got a couple of this week, but one in particular from Morgan Stanley talking about how the S&P could be down to 3,400 or even 3,000 in the worst case by the end of the year. And that sounds like a really bad number until you look at the second half of the statement, which is, and by the end of next year, we might be at 3,900. Well, at the time the statement was made, that's more or less where the S&P was. And so what he's essentially saying without coming out and saying it is, there's a lot of uncertainty out there right now. And we're not suggesting, we don't think the market's got a lot of room to run higher, but also, you know, over the span of the next year to 18 months, it's probably going to look more or less like what it looks, with the caveat that there'll be some volatility along the way. And so, Paige, we look at that and go, yeah, maybe no duh.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the point, right? You know, so like you were saying, we got that report out of Morgan Stanley, you know, targeting S&P at 3,400 by the end of the year. I read an article out of Barron's this week where they had interviewed 8 different strategists from different companies, you know, across the United States. Their lowest range that they had in terms of year-end expectations was 3,600. So that's not even quite as low as what Morgan Stanley is putting out there. The highest range of that was all the way up to about 400 or 420. So, you know, when you look at that type of range, when that is a very abnormal spread between what big banks are predicting for the end of the year. And I think it just underscores that there's a lot of uncertainty out there right now. We all know that uncertainty breeds volatility. And so I don't think that's going to go away by the end of the year. We have all these geopolitical factors that we have to worry about. We have the concerns of a recession. We have midterm elections, which those in and of themselves.
We
still have a pandemic, yeah. But, you know, those in and of themselves breed more volatility. And so when you have that type of spread of expectations just for this short period that we have through the end of the year, I think for me it just really drives home the point that nobody really knows. We can all try to look at the factors that exist and come up with our own estimates, but they're just estimates. And, you know, Art and I have talked about this many times, but it just underscores the point that don't try to time the market. We don't know when the rally is going to come. It could be this year. It could be next year. It could be 2024. But the big thing is that you don't want to miss out on that when it happens. And it's best to just stay invested, stay the course, tweak things based off of why we believe things are going to rally or not, and really just continue to, you know, stay focused on the long term.
And don't overextend. One of the quotes I put into my little note prior to the show, my grandpa, I said, little ship should stay close to the shore. Don't take more risk than you can afford to take. Design your portfolios for the long haul. We are confident that over long periods of time, you're going to make money. We're also confident that periodically you're going to lose money, and nobody likes losing money. I would have loved to have sold on January 3rd. I would have loved to have bought back in on July 1st. I would have loved to have sold again on July 31st. But we didn't know in advance those were going to be the dates at which we should have been doing what we should have been doing if we were timing the markets, which we don't believe works, and no one believes works. So, you know, just be well diversified, know what you have. And speculation is out there every day. And I marvel at Bitcoin going up just about every day that the NASDAQ goes up, and then that the NASDAQ goes up more this week than anything else. The NASDAQ has been up more since, you know, we hit bottom, whenever that was. And it's like you have to have some good growth stocks, but you don't necessarily have to have Bitcoin, and you don't want to be betting on a daily basis, as you said, you know, as to what, you know, what's going to happen.
Art, that sounds to me like your grandfather was worried about you wandering off. Just trying to keep you in line.
Yeah, it worked.
Well, we're glad we know. We're glad we know where you are, Art. I think keep our tabs on you at least for a little while longer. Joel, just a couple of economic indicators this week. Obviously, a short week and not a ton catching my eye. One thing that we've been paying some attention to: the strength of the consumer, the revolving debt, that credit card debt number one that maybe sparks a little bit of curiosity.
The paradox of thrift. You know, that says that, you know, 68% of our GDP is driven by consumer spending. We want consumers to spend, but we don't want them to spend all of their money so they don't have any. So that revolving credit number is a measure of credit card debt, basically. And it's now higher than it was. It's 3.5% higher than it was before the recession, before the pandemic. And so that recovered, and it suggests that people are still spending, even though they might not have the money to cover their bills, that they're borrowing more, but they're still spending. So that's good. I also looked, and this wasn't just released, but I looked to just to compare the personal savings for U.S. consumers is down. So the credit card debt is up. What did I find here? It's up 3.5%, but the personal savings is down 41% from where it was just before the recession. So that's a lower number, you know, and so people have less in savings and they're borrowing more for credit card debt. We don't know yet whether, I mean, that might be good news. It might be fueling the economy and things help, you know, get things better and we won't suffer a recession or we won't suffer a very difficult recession, but and maybe that's kind of dooming us for what's ahead.
And there was some room for savings rates to come down. There was some room for credit card spend to come up. And so I think a reminder that any single data point doesn't tell us much of the story. I think it is an interesting trend given where inflation has been, given where wage growth has been, right? A sign that maybe some spending that's taking place is taking place at those higher prices and has to come more on credit than it otherwise would have.
Right. And another point to that is getting back to Christopher Waller, the FedGov, he was saying that, you know, one thing that's giving the Fed more flexibility in keeping interest rates rising to combat inflation is the robustness of the job market. And we had more numbers this week on first filings for unemployment insurance, and those are the lowest they've been in 9 weeks. They're 37% below the 55-year average. So, you know, that part of the market is still looking good. And those are the sorts of things that, you know, even if your savings is down, if you've got a strong work environment, you know that you're not going to lose your job, you know that you're going to expect a pay raise, you're more apt to spend. So maybe that's going to get the confidence to keep the spending going.
The only other one I'd point to this week is the services index from the Institute for Supply Chain Managers. You know, I think we looked historically at manufacturing as the key driver of our U.S. economy, and that's transitioned over the past few decades to a much more service-based economy, a far more important measure than it ever used to be. I think the services readings, the service index readings, and pointing to economic growth that's right in line with what we would expect for slower but still sustainable growth.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, it's like a number of numbers that we look at, they're weaker, but they're still growing. And you know, the weaker we expect with the Fed raising interest rates, right? And, you know, to some degree, we expect that slow to, you know, go negative, but it's slow growth right now, and that's the same with the service sector. They also found in the that ISM report that there are, you know, fewer supply chain logistics and cost problems. So those are, you know, that's progress toward helping that sector.
And progress, hopefully, towards the inflation number as well. If supply chain has been such a significant part of the issue that we really think it has, as you look at kind of the global crisis for inflation, not just the crisis here in the U.S., I think all of those are things that point to an inflation reading that comes down with time and maybe an economy that starts to moderate a little bit, runs a little cooler than it has, but certainly in line with, you know, what we've come to expect over the, you know, the decade plus since the financial crisis. As always, we enjoy doing the show for you. We will talk to you again next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk at Landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at Landis.com.